Stars Over Surrey with Dave Gemmatis and John Axtell from the Guildford Astronomical Society.
Welcome, John. We're going to talk about the world of spaceflight and astronomy, your constellation of the month, what to look for in the night sky next month, and events at local astronomy societies. But first of all, what's going on in spaceflight and astronomy then, John?
Well, hi, Dave. Quite a few things to talk about this month. Let's start with the International Space Station. As you know, we have usually a crew of six on board, and that's been the case since the year 2000. So it's quite a feat having the space station manned continuously since then. Crew tend to go up in groups of three because that's the size of the Soyuz craft that takes them up there, and they're rotated. So they go up for a six-month stint. So every 3 months, one is coming down and another one going up. So that's the sort of routine, leaving a Soyuz, of course, up at the station, docked there as the descent vehicle for
crew. Emergencies. Indeed.
That's right. Absolutely. So we had another one of these routine launches earlier this month. In fact, it wasn't taking a crew of two. The Russians have been cutting back a bit. So it was just one Russian and one American astronaut going up to join the crew of three that are already up there. And the space station is crewed by a European, of course, at the moment, the German ESA, European Space Agency astronaut. All was going well, and I'm sure many of our listeners will have seen this on the news at the time. But after three or four minutes after the strap-on boosters successfully had finished their firing and separated, then the problem set in. What that leaves is the central core booster firing, and it's that started to go wrong. So the problem developed, reported by the mission commander on board, and so they had to make the instant decision to abort the mission. So the way they abort is to pull the Soyuz capsule away from the rocket launcher, and that's done by a separate little booster rocket that is held on the top of the Soyuz on a tower, and that is discarded after the normal launch. So that's what happened. They were pulled away successfully and then put into what's called a ballistic trajectory for return until they reached a point where the parachutes could deploy. But of course they're travelling at a bit of a faster rate than at this time than they would be under the normal aero braking that happens when they're returning from space. So it was a bit of a bumpy ride for the two, but the parachutes opened successfully and they came down about 250 miles north of the launch point of Baikonur. So the crew are safe and obviously taking part in the investigation. But the implications are quite serious. The Roscosmos, the Russian space agency, quite rightly immediately suspended all subsequent Soyuz launches and until they can determine what the fault was and come up with a remedy. And remember, this hasn't happened since about 1983 when there was a similar incident. So at the moment, there is no other route for crew transfer up to the space station. So the crew on the space station, as we earlier said, do have a lifeboat. They have a Soyuz attached in which to descend, but they're going to be asked to stay on longer. They would have returned in December, but they're going to be asked if they can stay on. I'm not sure whether that has yet been agreed. But if they do have to descend before another crew goes up there, then that could be a great risk for the space station, because that Soyuz that is up there has, of course, its own rocket motors on for re-entry, and it's those that are used to help adjust the space station if it has to move because a bit of space debris is spotted, and that has happened. They've had to shift its orbit in the past. And also, just because of the drag, although it's in space, there is still a tenuous little bit of the Earth's atmosphere at those altitudes. So there is drag, which causes the orbit to decay. And so a little quick burst on the Soyuz, the attached Soyuz rockets is what tends to be used to adjust that. If that Soyuz has come down with that crew, then we can't use those rockets. The space station could get into a tumble and may be destroyed. So let's hope that they can fix the problem fairly swiftly. This is an embarrassing failure for the Russians because it's come hard on the heels of last month's discovery that I reported of an air leak in the Soyuz that's attached to the space station. Fortunately, that air leak is in a part of the of the Soyuz that won't affect the crew, so that they're quite safe. But that was found to be, either deliberate, which hopefully not, or an error, but to have been caused during manufacture, because they put a little camera through and they found swarf on the outside. So it happened from the inside. So was it sabotage? And now with this happening, again, it might just be a little bit of the old Soviet mentality still existing in Russia today, but they've actually launched a criminal investigation. Not just an investigation, a criminal investigation. I think they like to have a scapegoat, somebody to blame, rather than the state or rather than the agency.
Well, what was the name of that horrible doctor in Lost in Space who was the saboteur?
Oh, I remember the series, but I've forgotten the name. I am sorry.
Bobby the Robot, of course.
Yeah. Oh, yes, of course. Yes.
No, Dr. What's the name? It's his fault,
definitely. Absolutely.
Or Elon Musk.
Ah, it could be, yes, or perhaps Boeing. The two contenders for the commercial well, they have got the commercial contracts to take astronauts up to the space station. So, yes, so maybe it's all a plot to make sure that all of the flights get switched to them as early as possible, but that won't be happening to next year. Okay. Anyway, let's hope that the Russians can identify that fault, because Soyuz really, really has been a very, very reliable workhorse.
Been very safe, hasn't it?
It has, yes. There have been deaths in a Soyuz craft, but that was on re-entry. That was Komarov a long, long time ago, and another set of people in Voskhod. I can't remember the number, but Soyuz is pretty well reliable. Okay, but whilst you mentioned Elon Musk and I also mentioned Jeff Bezos, let's mention Richard Branson. He announced that Virgin Galactic would be in space within weeks rather than months. This was a fortnight ago. So, can only be a few weeks to go. But, of course, remember that they're not launching a rocket with a capsule on top for fare-paying passengers. They're going to take them into space in a craft, like a mini shuttle. But that's taken up on a mother craft high. It will released, and then it will fire its motors to get up into space, but it's a suborbital hop. It won't go into orbit, couldn't reach the space station. He's gone on to say that not only will they have had their first test actually reaching space within weeks, he said that he himself will be in space, and his quotes are, within months rather than years. So let's hope that's absolutely right. And then fare-paying passengers will follow soon after. So there was, of course, a sad accident to their space plane, resulting in the death of one of the pilots, the co-pilot, and that was put down to human error. But a design remedy was soon put into place to ensure that error can't occur. So there has been quite a bit of delay in the Virgin Galactic space program. Whilst we're on that topic, Jeff Bezos has announced that Blue Origin's first suborbital manned flight will take place next year, 2019. It's not clear whether that's a test flight or with paying passengers, but his one will be, again, suborbital, but using a rocket, traditional sort of rocket called New Shepard, named after Alan Shepard, who was the first American who did a suborbital flight in Project Mercury. So this is New Shepard going up, launching a capsule with six or seven passengers in and a pilot, going up, becoming weightless, a few minutes up there in space, then coming back down again. But hey, great fun. I'd go if I could afford it. And if they had a rocket heavy with enough power to lift my bulk up there.
Well, are you on Amazon Prime? Because that's the starting point.
I suppose it would be, wouldn't it? Yes.
Amazon Super Mega Orbital Prime?
Sadly, no. Now, whilst we're up in Earth orbit, let's think about Hubble. Everybody loves all of the pictures that Hubble releases, nice pretty pictures. And of course, the scientific community absolutely love Hubble. A mirror that size in space, the core of the telescope outside of the Earth's atmosphere. Sadly, it's not working anymore. It's been put into safe mode, and all scientific research using Hubble has been suspended. Hopefully, that's short term. It's equipped with six gyroscopes for telescope pointing and orientation. Three of them are old, three are newer ones with enhanced facilities. Two of the old ones failed some time ago, but it operates on three with one as a spare. Now, the old one has now, the remaining old one has now failed, so just leaving the three. The engineers have tried booting up the standby gyro, but that particular gyro, which would have been one of the new ones, it was working on two new, one old, but that one is generating an awful lot of signal noise and is unusable. So they are trying to fix this with software, because nowadays we can't visit Hubble. In yesteryear, we used to send the space shuttle up, which had the capability of getting into a higher orbit than Soyuz can take a Soyuz rocket can take a Soyuz craft. So we can't have manned missions to service Hubble anymore, which is sad. So that means you can't take an old gyro out, stick a new one in, which is what's happened before. So they're looking for a software fix so that it'll enable the space telescope to operate with just two gyros, possibly even one. So I saw on the NASA website a couple of days ago that they believe that they are very close to a solution for that, and so it will begin operations again. Which is good, because its replacement, the James Webb telescope, is continually having budget overruns and delays. Yeah. Coincidentally, in the same week that Hubble was hit, Chandra, which is another excellent space telescope, this one not working in visible wavelengths of light, it's an X-ray telescope. That also had a gyroscope problem and had to go into safe mode. But that has now been fixed. You know, again, from the ground, it hasn't entailed a visit to fix it. Now, let's think about work that British space scientists have been involved with. And so that means European Space Agency. And we've just, the European Space Agency has just launched a mission to Mercury. It's called BepiColombo. BepiColombo is an Italian engineer and mathematician who worked out the maths for trajectories using planetary flybys for gravity assist to get to Mercury, and also worked on the discovery that Mercury rotates three times on its axis for every 2 years, two of its years for every two rotations around the sun. So the mission is named in his honour. But it's not just a European Space Agency. They're the leaders, I guess, because it was their rocket, an Ariane 5, and their space station base, launching base, which is in French Guiana. But it's being joined on this mission by JAXA, which is the Japanese Space Agency. I think it stands for Japan Aerospace Exploration Agency. I think that's where the letters come from. So those two spacecraft are mated together. You know, they were launched by Ariane successfully, and they're now on their journey to Mercury. Now, Mercury, of course, very close to the sun, so if you think, well, it's going to be easy to get to Mercury, all we've got to do is let the sun's gravity pull us in. If you did that, yeah, you'd get to Mercury pretty quickly, but you'd be going so flipping fast, you wouldn't be able to stop. And the idea is to go slowly to Mercury, so when you get there, its relatively weak gravitational field will capture the spacecraft at just the right orientation path so that it goes into orbit. So it's going to take 7 years to get to Mercury. And also we can save weight on the spacecraft and therefore put more instruments on board if we don't fill it up with loads of fuel, which is what you would have to do if it was a normal liquid-fueled sort of rocket on there. So this one is using electric propulsion, iron thrusters they're called, to get there. They generate a little power but work for a long time. And gradually build up acceleration or use it for slowing down. And a large part of the impetus for getting to Mercury is going to be provided by the gravity to other planets, Earth and Venus. So it's going to have a flyby Earth. It's going to return to Earth, use Earth's gravity to change its direction, which will then and slow it down, which will then sling it off towards Venus. And it'll go round Venus, have its orbit bent again in a big long loop that will bring it back to Venus again, which will again, in turn, change its orbit and point it now towards Mercury, slowing it down all of the time. It'll get to Mercury, and Mercury's gravitational field will pick it up and fling it again, another big long loop, bring it back to Mercury, another five times. So it's going to have six Mercury flybys before its orbit becomes stabilised and it will be in actual orbit around Mercury itself. So 7 years' time. Once the joint spacecraft gets there, then they're going to split. The European Space Agency is called Mercury Planetary Orbiter, and that will go into a relatively low orbit. And that will be studying the surface of Mercury and also probing into its interior using magnetometers and things of that sort. Maybe even ground-penetrating radar. I'm not quite sure of that. Whereas the Japanese MMO, Mercury Magnetosphere Orbiter, is going to be in a high orbit because that's going to study the planet's magnetic field and the interactions of that magnetic field with the sun. You know, the sun sends out this solar wind that we experience and we see as the aurora when it's captured by our magnetic field and brought down into the Earth's atmosphere around the poles. So they want to see what happens around Mercury. Mercury does have a magnetic field, but it's relatively weak. And that's a bit of a puzzle. Does Mercury have a liquid core, which is what you'd expect if there is a magnetic field? But other studies suggest no, it's dense, it's solid all the way through. So the two craft between them hope to answer that amongst many other questions. Because Mercury, quite close to the sun, is going to be hot, so those Spacecraft are going to have to be shielded to deal with the 660 degrees centigrade temperature that they will experience. But a tremendous, exciting launch. It's just such a pity that it's going to have to be 7 years of this program, Dave, before I can tell you what the results are.
We'll schedule that.
Okay, put a date in your diary now, listeners. Okay. Now, we've mentioned the Japanese in working with the Europeans, and we've got another example of that in our solar system at the moment. Last month, Dave, I'm sure you'll remember me talking about the spacecraft Hayabusa 2, which had deployed itself to the asteroid called Ryugu. So that last month, if you remember, I said had deployed two Japanese tiny little cake tin-sized landers to the surface. It has now deployed a third lander, but this one is called MASCOT, which stands apparently for Mobile Asteroid Surface Scout. And that's been built by the French company CNES, working with the German space agency as well. And so that has been released from Hayabusa to descend onto the surface of Ryugu. Now, the asteroid mission normally keeps Hayabusa something like 20 kilometres, I think it is, from the asteroid. But it closed in temporarily to within 50 metres of the surface just to deploy this lander. So there's no rockets on the or no thrusters of any kind on this little probe. So it just had to go in free fall. Ryugu's very tiny, so it was. But it does have a gravitational field, very very weak gravitational field. So it took 20 minutes for the asteroid to pull in MASCOT from 50 meters away. Okay. No doubt it was given a little bit of impetus by the direction that the Hayabusa was travelling in at the time. But it's equipped with four instruments, a camera, a radiometer, an infrared spectrometer and a magnetometer. So it landed quite safely, took measurements. Those have been replayed back to Hayabusa, are stored within it, and then it hopped, presumably using some kind of an internal spring that sprang outwards. It's hopped to a second location to deploy again and repeat those measurements to see if they were different in a different part of the asteroid. But it's dead now, because it was only powered by batteries. Simple little device, but so 17-hour battery life. It's done its job. And those results will be either back at the French and German agencies that designed the experiment, or still on Hayabusa, awaiting to be transmitted back at an appropriate time. Now, still within the solar system, but only just. Let's talk about Planet X. sometimes it's called Planet 9, because remember, we've now just got eight planets now that Pluto's been demoted to a dwarf planet. But this missing, this extra planet is hypothesized. Nobody's ever seen it, but astronomers have worked out that it ought to be there to explain some orbital oddities of other objects. Amongst them, things like one of the dwarf planets, which is called Sedna. Now, as we know, our solar system has the rocky inner planets, then an asteroid belt, debris left over from the formation of the solar system, then the four gas and icy giants, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus and Neptune. Then you go further out and you come across what's called the Kuiper Belt. And Pluto is merely a large Kuiper Belt object. But beyond the Kuiper Belt, there is what's called the scattered disk. And objects like Sedna and a few others, one of them rejoicing in the name 2012 VP113, that they are part of this scattered disk. Now, what's been noticed about those is that their perihelion point, which is the closest to the sun, is very much in the same part of the solar system. So, and it's not just those two, several others as well. So that is what has led scientists to believe there must be some massive planet further out that is shaping their orbits, because otherwise, how can we explain all of these nearest to the sun points being at about the same place? Now, the reason for introducing all that, Dave, is because that theory has now been given a huge boost by a newly announced exceedingly distant object that's just been discovered. And this belongs in well beyond what we call the scattered disk to something called the Oort cloud, O-O-R-T cloud, named after, I think, a Danish astronomer who hypothesized the existence of this. This is believed to be where many comets left over from the formation of the solar system come to us from. So at a huge distance, up to a light year away from the sun. So this object is believed to be an inner Oort cloud object. It's been called the Goblin. The reason for that is its official name is 2015 TG, hence the Goblin 387, and it was discovered at about Halloween, so that's why they've given it the name. So that's most appropriate given our time of the year now. Now, I said just discovered. It was discovered, in fact, in 2015, but scientists kept quiet about it because it's taken 3 years for them to work out what its orbit is. So they've only announced the discovery this month. It's tiny. It's only 300 kilometres in diameter, but it's 80 times as far from the sun as is the Earth. The distance between the Earth and the sun we call an AU, an astronomical unit. It's better than talking in umpteen millions of miles. So it's 80 AU distant. That's twice the distance of Pluto. All right. And to discover something that's only 300 kilometres across is an incredible feat. So it's very, very faint, very, very distant. And so that's why it took such a long time to study its orbit. But its orbit is highly elliptical. It will get as close to the sun as 65 astronomical units, but its aphelion point, the furthest from the sun, is 2,300 AU, which is colossal. It takes 40,000 years to go around the sun once. Okay, so it's a great discovery, but the relevance to Planet X is that it reaches perihelion in just the same area as all of these other objects that I've said, like Sedna. So it's supporting the conclusion that there's this massive but undiscovered body that's shepherding their orbit. So Planet 9, or Planet X as it's known. But, you know, some of us did Latin at school and learnt Roman numbers. We know that Planet X means 10, not 9. It would be IX for 9. So why these guys can't be consistent, I don't know. Planet X for mystery, perhaps. But one day, I'm sure, it will be discovered. Now, talking about our solar system, I suppose we ought to move out to other solar systems. We know that there are thousands of other solar systems that have now been discovered, exoplanets. Many of those have been discovered by the Kepler spacecraft. And the way that does it is to study a star and look for a tiny, tiny dip in the light of that star. And that's caused by a planet that happens to be in line of sight between us and that star, going between us and the star, therefore blocking out a little bit of that star's light. So it's exceedingly minor, but it is detectable by sophisticated instruments. Now, one of these exoplanets discovered by Kepler is called Kepler-1625b. Now, scientists know where it is. It's about 4,000 light years away in the constellation of Cygnus. That's where its star is. But when they discovered it, they thought there's something odd about this signal. They thought maybe it's not just a planet we've seen, but it's a planet with a moon passing in front of this star. So they've used the Hubble Space Telescope to study the star in question. And there were two things that they were looking for. A slight dip in the sun's light, either before or after the dip caused by the planet transiting across that star. The other thing they were looking for was, well, if there is a big planet round that, big satellite round that planet, then it would have an effect, a gravitational effect upon that planet. They would both wobble a little bit as they go round a common centre of gravity. So they were looking for either of those two things, and they detected both of them. So that seems pretty conclusive that that a particular exoplanet does indeed have a giant moon going round it. And they've calculated what its size would have to be to cause that kind of perturbation and that kind of dip in the sun's light. And it would be a Jupiter-sized planet with a rocky moon around it. So what that means is, if you think of Jupiter in our solar system, then it has large moons where we think possibly there could be life below the oceans, Europa. Also, we've got Saturn, where we've got Titan, but we've also got Enceladus, as a moon of Saturn, where there could potentially be life. So if we now know that Jupiter-sized planets around other stars also seem to have rocky type of moons, then maybe they're like the ones in our solar system, and they could perhaps be the places where life might exist. So this discovery has greatly increased the chance of life existing elsewhere, not just on other planets, but on moons around other planets. Most satisfying thought. Now, if there's life, there might be intelligence. So for a long time, we've had a campaign called SETI. And SETI stands for the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And they have been trying to detect radio signals from another civilization, assuming that a civilization would be such as ours, using radio for communication. So, of course, we haven't always used radio. We used to use Aldis lamps or signal flags. You know, maybe an advanced civilization has gone on to use something else. So now a university in California, the University of California at Santa Barbara, is now looking instead for lasers, assuming that perhaps an advanced civilization wouldn't use radio, it would use laser communication. So they're not looking in our galaxy, they're looking at our nearby galaxy, the Andromeda galaxy. So that'll be interesting to see if they find anything. They believe that we have the technology now to be able to detect any such lasers, even though it's, 2.5 or so million light years away. Okay.
I guess that wouldn't be a handheld laser like the one we use.
Not the sort we use as pointers during a lecture, no.
A little bit bigger.
Indeed. The sort of thing that maybe a bank of lasers like the one proposed to launch light sails to accelerate them up to 1/10 of light speed. Okay. Now, whilst we're thinking about distant objects, there's a star that's called C1 Tau, because it's a star within the constellation of Taurus. Now, that particular star is already known to have an exoplanet that's been discovered some while ago. It's only 500 light years away, so relatively close. And it's known that star's planet is one of these things called a hot Jupiter. Something that's as big, or if not bigger, than our giant planet Jupiter. But instead of orbiting way out in the solar system like our Jupiter does, these hot Jupiters orbit their parent star very, very closely. Now, so C1 Tau has been examined again, and scientists have discovered three more gas giants at C1 Tau. The outer two are Saturn-sized, whereas the inner two are, one of them is believed to be at Jupiter size, the other one is believed to be 10 times the size of Jupiter. Now, this is exceedingly puzzling, because we believe, from our understanding of the way our solar system formed, that a planet the size of Jupiter would have taken tens, if not hundreds of millions of years to slowly accrete and form into one huge gas giant. And most stars that have hot Jupiters are about the same age as Earth, our Sun, you know, billions of years old. However, C1 Tau is an exceedingly young star. It's only just been born in astronomical terms. It's only 2 million years old. You know, that's younger than Lucy, you know, our forebear, you know, Lucy in the sky with diamonds type of ancestor. So how could a star as young as that have helped to form such a large planet so quickly and so close? I don't have the answer. The scientists don't have the answer, because it does not conform to our understanding at the moment of how our solar systems form. So that's the wonder, one of the fantastic things about astronomy and planetary science is you have a theory, and then something comes along that makes you challenge that theory, and you have to go looking for another theory to fit, you know, the evidence that you now have. That's one of the great things to me about science. Last little topic, Dave, for today. And this was breaking news just a couple of days ago, back into our solar system and Mars. Now, you might remember me mentioning a few months ago that the European Space Agency's Mars Express spacecraft, which is orbiting Mars, that has ground-penetrating radar on board, that had detected subsurface lakes on Mars. A couple of them, one of them near one of the poles. Now, another discovery on Mars has been from the Curiosity rover from NASA. Now, that has discovered manganese deposits of some type on the surface. Now, that can only ever have been formed in the presence of oxygen. So these two facts, that there was a briny subsurface lake on Mars and there must have been oxygen sometime present, have prompted NASA to launch a study which has been conducted by JPL, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And JPL have just announced that they have concluded that that brine could actually hold a significant amount of oxygen and still be holding that. So what that means, it's a huge leap forward in terms of the possibility of life, an increase in the chance of life existing. Because up until now, the search for life on Mars has only been looking for the signs of, or the conditions to be right for, what's called anaerobic life, life that would exist without using oxygen. But now they're saying, and JPL are saying, that the amount of oxygen in these lakes could sustain what's called aerobic life forms. So multicellular organisms, even up to the level of a sponge, that sort of thing. So they're saying, and I quote from the leader of the JPL study team, This fully revolutionises our understanding of the potential for life on Mars today and in the past. So it's not just in the past, but it's today as well. So it's on that note, Dave, that I'll report. That's the end of my my space news for the month.
Thank you very much, John, for the update.
Stars over Surrey, constellation of the month.
So, what's your constellation this month then, John?
Well, Dave, it's bonus time, bonus constellation time. You've not just got one constellation of the month, you've got two. The first one is Pegasus, which is the winged flying horse, and I'm sharing it with Andromeda. The reason being that, in fact, they share a star anyway. The main part of the constellation of Pegasus is a box, the square of Pegasus, made up by four stars. And one of those four stars is actually now defined as being the brightest star in the constellation of Andromeda. So I'll deal with them both separately. First of all, we'll look at Pegasus, and that's got a fine Messier object in it, and then we'll look at Andromeda, which has got several. So I hope the listeners enjoy listening to, first of all, and then finding and studying these two adjacent constellations.
Great stuff, John. Now, what will our listeners be able to see in the night sky over the next month?
Okay, well, it's again a little bit like last month, in that we're in this transition between summer and the winter constellations. We still do have Cygnus the Swan, we have Altair and the Aquila the Eagle, we have Vega and the constellation of the Lyre. So those, the summer triangle is what I've just been describing. They're still there early to mid-evening. But by the end of the evening, then we've got things like a traditional winter constellation coming up, like Orion, which is probably the most identifiable constellation in the night sky, or tying perhaps with Ursa Major, the Great Bear, or the Plough, the part of it that most people know. So there's some splendid objects to be seen in the night sky. I'll give you a few pointers as to planets as well. For people that like moon watching, best time is going to be the 15th, when in the evening we're at first quarter, or if you're a morning person, then the third quarter is on Thursday the 1st of November. If you like looking at deep sky, faint fuzzy objects, then the best time is around the 7th of November, when we have new moon. And the full moon, which is attractive enough but causes an awful lot of light pollution, is on the 22nd of the month. Mercury, very poorly placed this month. It's very difficult. I will give you a pointer to possibly seeing it in just a few minutes. Venus, not really visible now. We've lost that. But it will be a morning object in the middle of the month, and will be getting brighter as the later month progresses. Mars is your best bet for planets during November. It's still a splendid object in the southern to southwestern sky. It's moving away from us now. We're drawing away from it. So it's not quite as bright as it has been. It's pinkish-red colour, which helps mark it out. And it's also a little higher in the sky as well. So easy to find. You really can't miss it. A bright pinkish-red object in the southwest, really, in the mid-evening. Jupiter, we've lost that as an evening object, but it'll be back with us before Christmas, so you'll get to see it later. Saturn, in theory, we can find it, but only as the first week of the month, but very, very low in the south-southwest sky, early evening object. Uranus, if you have a telescope, and Neptune are also good bets, but they're not visible to the naked eye. Uranus is the border of the constellations of Aries and Pisces, and is a fine object. It's a greenish, a small disk is what you will see through a telescope. But for both Uranus and Neptune, you do need to know exactly where you're looking, or have the kind of telescope that can find it for you, a go-to telescope, we call those. Events of interest. Well, I'll include the last few days of October, Dave, if I may, but given the date that this programme goes out. On the 27th, Saturday, Aldebaran will be only 4 degrees from the moon. So Aldebaran is the main star of the constellation Taurus. So if you're trying to learn your way around the night sky, use the moon to help you to find Aldebaran, and you'll know that you're looking at Taurus. And on the 30th, I've mentioned, you know, it will be hard to find Mercury and Jupiter because it's more or less gone. But if you are able to find Jupiter, on the 30th of October, then they'll be quite close together, 3.5 degrees apart, but very low in the southwest just after sunset. And then Jupiter is gone, effectively, for the rest of November. Do remember, of course, folks, summertime ends on the 28th, so don't forget to set your clocks by an hour back to GMT, or as they now call it, Universal Time. So a few events in November, but the highlight is going to be the 17th, really. That's the peak of the Leonid meteor shower. So on the evening of the 15th, quite a few bright meteors. And if you can stay up late, then it's best in the early hours of the 18th. And why not try to capture a meteor on your camera? If you can set it to, say, a 30-second exposure, you know, lay your camera on the back on the ground with as wide an angle lens as you possibly can, and set it off to a 30-second exposure. And if you've got a camera that allows you to do that automatically, as some of them do, take a series of 30-second exposures. And you never know, you might have a nice bright streak running through it that was a Leonid meteor. There are two other meteor showers this month, but nothing like the Leonids. On the 5th, it's the southern Taurid meteor shower, and the northern Taurids peak on the 12th. Again, to help you to find planets. As I said, Saturn, to all intents and purposes, has gone, but the moon will be only 1 degree away from it at sunset. So if you can find the moon at sunset on the 11th, then look for a bright spark nearby. That would be Saturn, but it will then be disappearing. Again, quite a nice sight will be on the 16th with Mars only 5 degrees from the moon. 5 degrees might not mean much to you. Just think about the size of your fist at arm's length. That will be 5 degrees. So it's that kind of distance from the moon. And the same sort of distance to help you to find Uranus. On the 20th, find the moon, then look a fist's distance above it, north, in other words, and you should see something that's star-like, but won't be scintillating like a star. It's just maybe you might see a small disc there. Depends on how good your binoculars or telescope are. That will be Uranus, a greenish tinge. A few meetings at local societies for you, Dave. My own society, Guildford, meeting in the Lecture Theatre L at the University of Surrey on Thursday the 1st at 7:30. It's Dr. Gina M. Halabi from University of Cambridge, and she's going to be talking about the intimate lives of stars. Our next nearest society is Farnham, meeting at Aldershot Cricket Club, Tuesday the 13th at 7:45. One of their own members, Charles Dixon, talking about galaxies and large-scale structures. Over to Croydon, still within Surrey, Royal Russell School, Coombe Lane, Croydon. They meet fortnightly, so because of the way the dates fall, they have three meetings this month, Friday the 2nd, Friday the 16th and Friday the 30th. On the 2nd, Professor Gary Hunt from Cambridge, still I think an emeritus professor at Cambridge, he's talking about the Voyager legacy. The subject for the 16th is still to be announced, but on the 30th they have Professor Alan Aylwards from UCL, University College London, talking about aurora, but not just on Earth, but on other planets too. And we've had fantastic photographs returned from space missions of aurora on Saturn and aurora on Jupiter. Our last society, Ewell, again, just on the borders of Surrey, North Surrey, Nonsuch High School for Girls at Cheam, Friday the 9th, 7:45. Professor Carolyn Crawford, again from Cambridge, and the Institute of Astronomy. And I believe that Carolyn's just taken up a position as a government advisor on astrophysics and so on. Dark energy and the ever-expanding cosmos. I can't tell you about the sky at night because as we're a little early this month, I'm afraid the BBC's projection of programmes doesn't go quite as far. But remember, it's usually on the second or third Sunday of the month and then repeated the following Thursday. So watch out in Radio Times or in due course when their website shows what's going to be on. There we are, Dave. That's my What's Up for November.
Thank you, John, for the fascinating insights. This show will be repeated on Monday night at 11 p.m. and is available after transmission as a podcast. The podcast will also have more items that we couldn't fit into the broadcast. The next edition of Stars Over Surrey will be Friday, 30th of November. Thank you, John.
Indeed.
Stars Over Surrey with Dave Jemetis and John Axtell from the Guildford Astronomical Society.